Do you know that feeling when everyone is talking about a movie that you haven't seen? Have you ever felt compelled to make some vague comments just so you can join in the conversation? Well, what if you were in too deep? Do you think you could convince everyone that you'd seen it? Or do you think your version would be so much better that no one would care? Here at Faking Movies, we're always the ones who haven't seen the movie.
Anything you can do better. I can do anything better than you.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
All right, much like Sidney Prescott in Scream 1, I'm Lee, and this is Faking Movies. Welcome back.
So much like Sidney Prescott.
This is episode 76.
Salt,
trombones.
See, I was gonna do a 1776 joke, and you're doing.
I was thinking about doing some bicentennial humor, but like, yeah. How many times can Gerald Ford fall down a flight of stairs before it gets, you know? Old?
There you go.
Yeah, I was gonna do the hit musical 1776, where they talk
starring
about
William Daniels.
Yeah, talking about my two favorite topics: saltpeter and pins.
Oh, two things that can make you sterile in different ways.
Oh my. All right. Yeesh. I mean, Seth needed a second.
Yeah. No, that's just a joke. Stop. Peter does not make you sterile. That's just an old wives' tale.
I just
pins, though.
Oh, fuck, you broke him. Oh, you broke him good.
Oh, that's, in case you're wondering, that's my dear friend Seth. Hey, Seth, what's up? God. How you doing?
Rest in peace, Seth. He dead now.
Wowzers.
And also, of course, I'm joined with my dear friend Zach. What's up, Zach?
Not much. How are you?
I'm doing God.
Wonderful. This is the, I think anybody who actually listens to the show, all four, I think you know that we have taken to recording a lot of them back-to-back, and this is the second of a back-to-back. We are feeling loose.
Oh, my God. No one is surprised.
And if you love this loose content, why don't you also check out our Instagram, our Twitter, and our website.
The air is thick with Rhea.
Oh, good. We got that steam. It is getting brushed into the enamel of our teeth.
My
this
eyes.
Week, we have got Zach. Oh, it's trapped under my contact lenses now. Zach, what are we doing this week? Boy,
oh, my God.
I'm doing Cool
Wait,
Hand
give me
Luke.
A second.
Seth is catching his breath. Yeah, Cool Hand Luke. Me a bunch of old white guys.
This movie is almost entirely old white guys. So.
Yeah, seemed right.
Well, at the time, not necessarily all old, but some of them looked very old for sure. Well,
no
that's
doubt.
A spoiler.
A lot of these.
You mean
are,
all of them?
Yeah, a lot
I was
of these
thinking
are
mostly
always
of Harry
old.
Dean Stanton.
Yeah. Yeah, Harry Dean Stanton has never been a young man.
He's always old for sure. Yeah.
He has that Benjamin Button disease, but he never like got any younger.
He just got time stuck. Yeah.
Yeah, he just got time stuck right at the beginning, and he has been, you know, that age since birth.
Yep. Harry Dean Stanton, famously 16.
Briefly here to Zach. One of my cats is just rubbing her face all over my microphone, so you may have some trouble.
Perfect.
This
Love
one.
It. That'll be great.
Oh, boy. Yeah,
awesome.
Butch, stop it. You're such a good kitty.
I've annotated them all so I could keep them straight. I had to look up two of them. I wasn't sure who they were, but anyway.
Oh, which ones did you have to look up?
What are the actors? Yeah, just give us all the
Yeah, give us the whole list.
So, Paul Newman, old famous. George mm-hmm. Kennedy, old fat. I didn't know him. Clifton James, old Southern sheriff. Also didn't know him. Dennis Hopper, old motorcycle. And Harry Dean Stanton, old big love, of course.
Okay. Yes, old big love. Have you ever seen the Naked Gun movies, Zach, or the Police Squad television show?
Yeah, Naked Gun, yes.
George Kennedy is the chief in those movies.
Oh, mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah.
Who was the other person you didn't recognize?
Clifton James. He looks like a sheriff.
He is the recurring Southern sheriff in the Roger
Nailed
Moore
it.
Era James Bond movies.
That's yep. I literally wrote old Southern sheriff. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Perfect. Okay. So here goes.
Okay.
Set in the 1970s, when any of these actors could have even barely passed as, quote, young. Paul Newman is a pool shark, our titular Luke.
You do know that there is a completely different, incredibly famous series of two Paul Newman movies where he plays a pool shark, right?
Yeah, right.
I super duper did not know that. I hope I didn't know one of those.
He won Best Actor for one of those movies.
Oh, fun. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Okay, go on while you remake The Hustler.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, I doubt it.
You goofed it real hard, Zach.
We'll see. okay, we see him win many, many rounds at various pool bars around town, sharking people out of their money to support his family and his always on his luck brother, George Kennedy, with whom he works. So they run an ice cream shop owned by Dennis Hopper. George is always up to some new con or scam, trying to figure out how to make them some real money. Of course, none of this ever actually works.
Of course.
Yeah. Paul is out sharking one night against the overly confident local fixture, Clifton James, always with a cigar in his mouth, as Google Pictures would have suggested to me earlier today.
So I'm sorry, but you are literally just talking about The Hustler, because Jackie Gleason plays this character in The Hustler.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, this is a very obvious, counterpart to the protagonist pool shark. Like, makes sense.
Sure. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay.
So
like, he's even fat. Like, they're both fat, is what I'm getting at.
Oh, yeah. Sure. Clifton knows that Paul is better than he lets on, but he constantly plays him anyway and loses money to him because he's convinced that he can beat him and be the de facto sort of local pool champion, which I guess is a prestigious position.
Sure, why not?
In the right kind of town, I think it would be. Yeah. After losing a particularly bad round, he spouts some nonsense about, yeah, we'll see who the winner is tomorrow. And so next scene, we then the next day Paul shows up to work to find his strung out brother smoking a cigarette outside, looking particularly pathetic. As he goes to walk in, Clifton, the brother, mutters something like, "Don't bother." After some questioning, he reveals that he's been quietly skimming the more expensive ingredients and selling them to other stores around town. It appears that Clifton knew about this, as he owns one of the stores that was receiving these goods and ratted them out to Dennis Hopper, the ice cream shop owner, in an act of revenge. Weeks go by with no luck finding new jobs, and they decide to lean into the pool sharkery, as it seems like the only real way to make money now. Paul,
this also feels a lot. This also feels a lot like Pope of Greenwich Village, if I'm being honest.
It has a similar feel to it, certainly.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
More on that later.
More on that later.
Okay. Paul's now going out every night, but we find that his skills have waned. He can no longer handily beat anyone in town like he used to be able to. Frustrated and filled with false confidence, he takes all of the money they currently have and challenges Clifton to make a big score to tide them over. It's very close. It's a very exciting game, but Clifton wins by one ball to his great pleasure. He brags quite a bit, as one would expect, and tells Paul he's welcome to come try to win back his money anytime he likes. Extremely frustrated that Clifton now has gotten them fired and taken all their money, Paul and George go to leave in shame until they're stopped by a shadowy character.
Oh, is this Harry Dean?
Enter Harry Dean Stanton, of course. We realize he's been there the whole time, quietly watching everyone play pool, but never really noticed him.
You had him like pulling a Strider in the back corner, just lit up by a pipe.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
that there is like Strider. Some say he's a Ranger.
You know what always bothered me about the movies is he doesn't carry around the shards of Narsil with him, which are his birthright.
He should have, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, in the books, they reforge it during Fellowship. Like, it's not like it's a... anyway.
It's not like anyway. A reveal later. Yeah.
Yeah, they save it for fucking the fucking pass between the mountains with the army of the dead, and Elrond finally, oh, you are my fake son who can bang my dad. Anyway, so.
Uh-huh. okay, so sage-like, Harry Dean Stanton drops some thickly veiled rhetorical questions about when did you notice that your skills waned? Like it's been plainly obvious the whole time. Leaning on some truly dubious science.
Oh shit, I just got your freaking story. Uh-huh, oh my god. Uh-huh. Okay.
Leaning on some truly dubious science, it's implied that all of the ice cream scooping was conditioning his hands in some sort of cryotherapy way to be extra steady and extra accurate.
See, I thought Harry Dean Stanton was going to be the devil secretly, but
I definitely thought that, but
now you're thinking of Angel Heart. This is a lot of
different one. No, he's more of a Yoda character, if anything. Yeah.
He does have the wrinkles for it.
He sure do. He sure do. Harry finishes up with, "It was the cool hand, comma Luke."
Split it up.
Yep. So, I mean, that was a word boundary, to be fair, but yeah.
Yeah, no, that was a normal boundary in English. So, yeah, no worries. Yeah,
okay, so we get a montage of them at the local bar during the day when it's dead empty, with a cooler full of dry ice testing out this theory.
Cooler full of dry ice?
Yeah, not ice cream. They're going like straight for it. They're flying way too close to the sun. Yeah.
Yeah.
So they eventually figure out the exact sort of timing and temp that maximizes this effect, and challenge Clifton again to his great surprise. He didn't think they were coming back. This time, they have to bet Paul's house as it's all they've got left. Clifton, riding high, accepts this bet and puts up $40,000 on his end. This time, Jesus. They're pretty evenly matched. It appears that Clifton has actually gotten a bit better. And Paul hasn't also totally figured out how the cool hand system works, because they're sort of new to it.
He's been playing left-handed the whole time, and really he's right-handed.
Maybe not that far, but sure, yeah.
Aww.
There's definitely a scene where Paul leaves mid-game to go get a quick cool hand fix in the parking lot.
This is really weird. It just makes it sound like he went into the back room to jerk off.
that's the impression I got as well.
He can feel it wearing off, so he's like, I'm gonna get a cigarette, and he runs out and just like dunks his hand in some ice water.
Getting myself a stranger, boss.
There you go. Anyway, it's all down to the same one ball scenario at the end, but this time Paul, of course, wins, taking the money and the respect of the entire town, since no one, of course, liked Clifton in the first place. And we close on them back in the ice cream shop on some line about, I can't believe Dennis Hopper decided to sell it to us, and remarking how it's great to be back to being Cool Hand Luke.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it.
Okay, so you made the Hustler. Cool.
Yeah, you made the Hustler.
I did kind of Hustler Greenwich Village. Yeah. Didn't really see it at the time. Yeah.
Do you want to know why I said Greenwich Village? Because the same guy directed Cool Hand Luke.
I'm picturing, I know it's Paul Newman, and I know who Paul Newman is, but it kind of feels like a young Mickey Rourke character. He's like always down on his luck and like irritatingly charismatic. It's kind of that kind of.
I could see there being a time when they wanted to make Mickey Rourke like a less pretty Paul Newman.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Down on his luck, charming Paul Newman characters that I could see a young Mickey Rourke also like being able to play.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, but I didn't find Paul Newman's charmingness ever irritating in this movie.
He is
charming throughout, and it is never irritating.
Yeah, people talk about star power, and he had like this charm, and like that's really what a good portion of this movie's about. But
yeah, okay, it is.
I feel like a lot of people from that era turned out, or maybe not even turned out, just were fucking monster people. But like Paul Newman's actually an okay dude, right?
No, he is definitely an okay dude.
Hey, I mean, him and Joanne Woodward are one of Hollywood's great love stories. I mean, they stayed together his entire life.
All the salad dressing profits go to charity and all that shit, right? I think. Mm-hmm.
And he's best friends with Robert Redford, and Robert Redford is cool as well. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Sweet. No, like, they were two classic Hollywood dudes that were actually good people.
Yeah.
Unlike against so many.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At least as far as we know, at least. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. Uh huh. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Zach, do you want the one sentence IMDb summary?
Oh, of course, yes.
Which I don't really think encapsulates this movie at all, but that's fine.
Okay.
A laid-back Southern man is sentenced to 2 years in a rural prison, but refuses to conform.
That is not vague and brief. Yeah.
And not accurate, because that's not real. Like, he's in prison, yeah, but there's more to it, I think. That doesn't do a good job at all. All
right. Sure enough.
Yeah. I'll get into it here in a second. I think what they're maybe tapping into is, like, this is for a very long time been noted as, like, an anti-establishment type movie.
Yeah.
So they're really like, well, like, on the poster, the tagline on the poster is "The man and the motion picture that simply do not conform."
Yeah, it's true. It was marketed as such, but
It came out during Vietnam, so there's, like, you know.
I was gonna say this is like early mid '70s.
This is 67.
Very late '60s. Yeah.
Oh, so early Vietnam. All right.
Yeah. Really, really early.
So and every a lot of people in the film are war vets that then went to prison. Like, Paul Newman, notably, was a war vet.
World War II. It's set in the early '50s, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So I can give you a little more in depth, since that one sentence summary wasn't all that great.
By all means, yep.
Opens up with Paul Newman getting arrested for, like, cutting the tops off of parking meters drunk one night, just 'cause. Like,
great thing to go down for. Yeah.
Yeah. No, he just has, like, a pipe saw and is just walking around town cutting off the heads of parking meters.
That's with a couple of beers. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking, like, bashing him with baseball bats or something. But
Nope. Yeah. Like, very, like, matter-of-factly, like, ambling along, very well shot, just, like, twisted around a couple times, plop.
Yeah.
Twisted around a couple of times, drink an entire beer, twisted around a couple times, plop.
Sure. Like you do.
Yeah, and he's got a bottle opener around his neck on a chain, you know, like.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's having himself a boring night out.
He's having a Tuesday. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
It really feels like it was a Tuesday. Yeah. He gets arrested. He gets sent to be on basically an outdoor work prison. Like, it's a chain gang, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the whole movie takes place while he's on this chain gang. And they're, you know, they do road work. And there's a bunch of different characters that we meet along the way. Harry Dean Stanton is another one of the prisoners, and plays a guy who he plays guitar, and there's a lot of scenes underscored with him playing old spirituals and singing them.
Oh, okay.
Which plays in really heavily to all the Jesus Christ imagery that they do.
Christ imagery, but I'll talk about that later.
Yeah.
The Christ imagery.
George Kennedy is kind of like the de facto leader of all the prisoners. His nickname is Dragline. And he's like the tough guy, and he runs all the betting, and he does this and that, and he ends up, like, taking a shining to Luke, because shortly after Luke arrives, they kind of butt heads, and him and Luke have a boxing match where basically Luke won't stay down is the whole story of it. He is basically beaten to exhaustion. He has no chance of winning, and he just won't stay down, and he earns everyone's respect.
Sure
And then that night he gets his nickname Cool Hand Luke while they're playing poker. Even though Dragline's still kind of like the leader, Luke is the one that everyone looks up to at this point.
Right, okay. Like
he's a very, very beloved character to everybody at the prison, but he's very, like, laid back. Like, Yeah, he's really not causing trouble in any way, shape, or form. He's just kind of chilling.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And he just more or less doesn't give a shit.
Yeah. Sure. Mm-hmm.
And then Dennis Hopper plays one of the prisoners, but how did you put it, Seth? That he's a simple fella?
Yeah, it seemed like they were clearly trying to characterize him as somebody who is in prison not because of any like violent crime or anything, but because he made some mistakes and was somehow mentally retarded.
That is the thing that kind of
Made me think of Benji in The Sound and the Fury a little bit.
Yeah, I saw that in there too.
I don't know if I'm just drawing on like this is a someone who would go on to be a famous actor and their first role is playing like a very childish adult, like Robert Redford did in To Kill a Mockingbird.
Right.
Oh shit. Yeah.
Not Robert Redford. I'm sorry, Robert Duvall.
Robert Duvall, right.
Hang on.
Yeah, no, and, I don't know if I'm just
Ben
drawing.
Stiller did in Simple Jack.
Famously.
I don't know if I'm like drawing that parallel just out of, you know, time period, because these movies aren't that far apart, actually, in time period. But
no.
Anyway, so a lot of the movie takes place just with the comings and goings of their daily life in the prison. And like we see a lot of Luke just kind of pushing against authority a little bit, but never like intensely.
Yeah, like he's kind of friends with some of the guards and he ribs them a little bit, but they're like cool with it because he's such kind of a model prisoner. Like he does his work, he stays in line, he does all these other things, but he still ribs them a little bit at the first half of this movie.
Okay.
And he gets a visit from his mom who's really, really sick. And that kind of like you could see it shakes him. And a little while later we find out that she died. Uh-oh. And he's not allowed to go to the funeral or anything like that. They do, they make a comment about a man whose mother has just died and the funeral's going on, gets it in his head that maybe he needs to go. So we're taking you off the road crew for a while and we're going to put you in the box.
Yes, which they put him in solitary
for doing nothing, essentially.
For doing, they claim that he got rabbit in his blood now, and they needed to keep him under control until after she was in the ground to make sure that he didn't try to escape to go to the funeral.
How speculative!
Like, instead of treating him like a human being and trusting him in any way, shape, or form for his like reasonably nonviolent crime that he's in prison for, they dehumanize him and they're like, "No, you need to be put into solitary because this is how it goes."
Right.
So like, and this act of inhumanity by the guards, I think, is the real tipping point.
Throughout the movie, you can see them doing this to other characters, like, and it's kind of just happens on the periphery of the scenes, but like, happens to Luke, and everybody's like, "Oh, Luke's fine. He like this. It ain't right what they're doing, but they're not gonna break Luke."
Yeah, and it doesn't break Luke.
It doesn't break him in the sense that he like just kind of gives up. It actually breaks him in the sense that it inspires him. So that's when that's when he escapes the first time.
Yeah.
he basically tunnels out on the 4th of July and he gets away and he doesn't get away for very long, but he
gets brought back that same night. He doesn't get too far. No.
Right. Right. And they put him in leg irons because that's what you do when you get caught escaping. They put you in leg irons. So then there's a sequence where he goes and one of the guards is talking about like, "Oh, Luke, you're an okay guy. Like, I understand. It's fine." You know, he gives him his life wisdom about, because Luke also doesn't believe in God and that's a big thing. And he's like, "I understand now why you've gone the wrong path. It's because you don't have God, but it's okay." And he's like, I got to go to the bathroom. They're like, "Okay, go over there. Just make sure you shake the bush while you're doing it. So we know you're still there."
As an indicator that you're not escaping, I guess?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And he escapes again because what he was doing, he had a big long string and he tied it to the bush and he just kept shaking it.
Smart.
Yeah.
Okay. And he escapes again and he runs into two African-American children. And it's kind of weird because...
Mm. Yeah.
These are the only black people in a movie about a Southern chain gang.
Yeah. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I thought actually that those two child actors did a really good job.
No, they were terrific. In their brief scene. It's just the movie didn't seem to like understand that in the South in the 50s, maybe all white people who did white collar crime weren't the most likely chain gang.
Yeah,
certainly.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some confusing bits there.
Although the guy who wrote the book that it was based on did serve on a chain gang in this time period.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yikes.
So I'm sure he is drawing at least a little bit from his experience. So he escapes again, and he escapes for a while this time.
He sends 2 weeks or something.
Yeah, he sends a magazine back to the camp for the prisoners, and there's a picture of him in there with these beautiful women, and it's like, oh my god, Luke made it. And then he gets dragged back in, and he's all beaten to hell, and he admits that was a fake. He just wanted to send it for the guys, you know.
Sure.
He just was working shit jobs and finally got caught. And that's when they start to like beat him, like
they like
really bad.
Beat him and make him do like even on days off, make him do extra manual labor. Like,
well, they literally make him dig a grave.
Yeah,
over and over again.
They make him dig a grave and like they're like, oh, well, that's boss whoever's patch of dirt, or that's boss whoever's ditch, and there's dirt in that ditch. Why is your dirt in that man's ditch?
Oh,
and then as soon as he pulls it all out, they're like, oh, why is all this dirt in my lawn? And so, like, he has to go back and forth for, like, you know, 48 solid hours of digging his own grave. And then,
he finally collapses in the grave, and he begs them not to hurt him anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And they finally let up a little bit on him.
Yeah. Oof.
And then it's like, and then he's broken. He's broken at that point.
He's like doing the bitch prisoner work for all of the guards. Like he's like become a traitor, and everybody loses all of their respect for him.
Okay.
And then one day, they're like, "Hey, Luke, go get the water for everybody." He runs to the truck and gets the water. And then one of the guards is famously he has no eyes. They say he wears these mirrored sunglasses the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yeah,
seems like that would make for a bad prison guard.
No, it's actually it's
very menacing.
Like a really nice iconic villain.
Okay.
His like indifferent cruelty is really palpable.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. And he, you know, he's like, Luke, go get my gun. And he goes and he gets the gun out of the other truck. And he's like, the guy shoots a turtle. And he's like, Luke, go get that turtle. And he goes and gets it. And they're like, all right, Luke, go put it in the truck. It's for lunch. And he runs and he goes to put it in the truck. And he jumps in the truck and he starts to drive away. And
they missed an opportunity for, hey, prisoner, go get the gun from the truck. What?
Well, I mean, they don't keep the bolt in the rifle.
The man with no eyes always has the bolt.
Okay, that's
and
much more sensible.
And he's surrounded by, you know, 10 other prison guards that all have
shotguns.
Yeah, there's
a ton of guards there, yeah.
Oh, yeah, all right, sure, okay.
Yeah,
yeah.
So he jumps in the truck and he starts to drive away, and Dragline, who, like, at this point, just he looks up to Luke more than anyone, almost.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Jumps in the truck with them, and they escape together.
Hey!
Okay, well...
And they get away for a little while because it turns out when he went to the other trucks, he took the keys from them.
Oh, smart. Okay.
Yeah. So he took the keys from every other vehicle possible. Yeah. And so
he's good at this escaping shit. Hmm.
Yeah, he really is. Not staying escaped though. That's the problem.
No.
So him and Dragline run for a while, and then they're going to split up to go their own way.
Mm-hmm.
And Luke ends up in a church,
and he talks to God.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
And
sort of like he's like, "Hey, old man, like you done me a raw deal. Like, show me some sign if there should be any reason I should believe in you."
Oh, okay,
yeah. And then of course
the cops show up. And Dragline shows up, and he says, "They caught me, and they said that that they." Let you go back to jail, and they wouldn't hurt you if you gave yourself up. Because one of the things he also is they told him if he ever escaped again, they'd shoot him on sight.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Um, And he sticks his head out the window and he mocks the prison warden and he gets shot right in the throat.
Ooh, yep. Well, all right.
And yep. Dragline drags him out and attacks the man with no eyes and he rips his glasses off and the warden is grabs him. He's like, pick him up. And the cops who are there are like, we're going to call the emergency hospital. We'll be there in a few minutes. He's like, no, we're taking him to the prison hospital. And it's like, well, who's going to die on the way?
Yeah.
And
like he's responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when Luke hears that, he smiles and they drive away. And it's implied. It's heavily implied that he's dead.
Yeah.
Yep. So that he dies on the way. Yeah.
And then the movie ends with Dragline telling everybody about this, and they have a weird like montage of like clips from throughout the movie.
Was really the weakest part of the whole movie was this ending montage.
Because he keeps talking about, and then Luke smiled that smile, that Luke smile, and then there's just pictures of Paul Newman smiling, and the last shot of the movie is a picture of him superimposed over a crossroads. And it fades in to kind of look like, you know, he's being crucified a little bit. Yeah, yeah.
Speaking of heavy-handed,
it is heavy-handed. It's very heavy-handed. And I know that we went a little longer with the description than we usually do, but we did leave out a lot of the more interesting parts.
We left out, the interesting bits. So
yeah, that just sounds like a huge bummer, honestly.
this movie, I loved this movie, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, you said that when you were watching, that you didn't necessarily remember, but it might be one of your favorite movies.
Yeah, it might be. Okay. I think that like the way that it's shot and the way that it's paced, even though it's, you know, a little over 2 hours, like I was rapt the entire time.
It is very engrossing. Good marker. Yeah.
Yeah. But this movie, what's more interesting about it is that it has so many iconic scenes that have been parodied in everything else in the world. Weird. So and yet nobody knows that they're from this.
I
had thought that I had seen this movie and I knew more or less what it was about.
Uh-huh.
And then watching it last night, I realized I did not ever see this movie. I had just seen all of the movies that reference this movie.
Is like a major one of those cinematic blind spots we're always talking about.
Yeah, sure.
One of those iconic scenes, two of them I knew were from this movie. One of them I had no idea was in this movie.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about those at all, Seth?
Yeah. So, like, they're probably the three scenes that you're talking about is there is the line that the warden says the first time that Luke gets caught and he's being, like, drawn out in front of everybody else. And he says, "What we have here is a failure to communicate."
Oh, certainly. Yep.
Right. Okay. And that's from this. And in fact, that's at the end of the movie what Luke says to mock the warden.
Oh.
When they're like, he's standing in the window of the church and they're all telling him, you got to come out here. And he just goes up to the window and is like, what we have here is a failure. And then they shoot him in the throat.
Right.
But that line is from this.
Yeah.
Which is like, it has been parodied and homaged so many times in so many movies.
Yeah.
It was really, when I was reading a little bit about the making of this movie, they didn't want to put that in originally.
Interesting.
Because they thought because it's supposed to take place in Florida. And they thought that at this time period, like, a prison work gang foreman wouldn't talk like that. And then, when they did some like researching into it, this was around the time when like new theories of incarceration and recidivism were like actually starting to get implemented in the US.
Uh-huh.
So the actor who plays that character decided, well, he probably has like had to go and take classes about this to keep his job.
Oh, sure.
And he doesn't like it, but he uses some of it to like justify what he's doing.
Yeah. Okay.
Which I thought I was very surprised. Like, it's a great line, and I think it. Mm-hmm. Like, it didn't even faze me. I thought, like, yeah, this character is weirdly, like, he's evil in a very strange way, And it didn't phase me at all that he would talk that way. But like now knowing that there was so much thought put into it, it made it much more interesting.
Yeah, for sure. That's cool. The second scene that I want to talk about is
Can we do the eggs last?
Yeah, I was planning on doing the eggs
last. Perfect.
Oh,
okay.
Oh my. Yeah. Oh dear.
So I'm talking about this fucking ridiculous scene that has happened in so many movies, but this is the first one that did it.
This is the scene that I did not realize it was from Cool Hand Luke, but have seen it so many times.
Yeah, okay. Is when there is like a group of dudes, be they construction workers or prisoners or whatever, and then a hot lady comes out and washes a car in front of them.
Oh, and this is the first example? That's almost so ubiquitous that it's hard to attribute it to anything at this point.
Yeah, but it can be attributed to this film.
Like, especially when you watch it and see the specific shots that have been like recreated over and over again.
Like pressing her breasts against the car window, from inside the car, and like wringing out a sponge. And oh no, suddenly my blouse is all wet. How could this have happened?
Like, that's so weird. So the summary that Lee gave, that type of scene does not fit the tone of this movie at all.
That's the thing.
It doesn't. Like,
because they're constant. The chain gang is constantly doing different manual labor in different places along roadsides. Okay. And so there's a lot of different sets where you have a lot of interaction with different people. Mm. And one of them is like, you know, them seeing this farmer's daughter in the middle of a dirt farm wherever.
Who they refer to as, well, at least Dragline refers to as Lucille, because ain't nothing so pure could do something so dirty and not be named Lucille.
Oh dear.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ooh, all right.
Yeah, and that just like all of these horny dudes are just panting over her this entire time, and it's
gross, it's like, and it doesn't really do anything. Yeah,
it's a gross scene. Like the only thing that it does is establish kind of a camaraderie between the dudes because this is very early in the movie, but like it's dumb.
Right. It also does give Luke like his ultra like I'm above all of this moment, like his first one.
He does,
because
yeah.
One of the guys says something like, oh, God, she doesn't even know what she's doing. And Luke goes, she knows exactly what she's doing.
Like, obviously, don't be naive, you dumbass dickbag.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. Of course.
That kind of reminds me of another little, like, through line of the movie. Dragline keeps getting, one of his relatives keeps sending him, like, erotic novels. And they read them out loud, like, and it really reads like a romance novel. It's kind of nice to see like romance fiction, which gets shit on all the time, being given like an actual prominent role in a movie, because the people who fucking write romance can fucking write. Like
it's true.
I heard something about some eggs.
Yeah, Lee, you want to talk about that egg scene?
I want to talk so much about the eggs. There's a character who one of the prisoners is like, he can eat anything, and like they do, you know, it's one of the, they bet on everything because they got nothing else to do.
This isn't going back to Angel Heart, is it? Did Angel Heart rip this up?
Oh shit! I didn't even think of it. It's the same director. No wait,
oh, fuck.
It's not the same director.
You guys keep mixing up Angel Heart and Pope of Greenwich Village.
How many like, eggs are Mickey in the Pope Rourke of Greenwich is... Village?
Between
unless
zero
it was
and a
like
bunch,
a brioche, then I don't really know how many were in any of the bread sandwiches they ate.
Mm. I mean, you're not gonna have two Italian guys making a brioche sandwich, Seth. Come on.
Probably not.
That's a hearty Tuscan loaf. Come on.
Okay, well, I don't know nothing about none of that. I'm just a simple farmer.
Simple country
lawyer. I'm just
lawyer.
Here farming this dirt.
I'm just a simple PhD farmer, farming up these PhDs.
Building harpsichords out of nothing at all.
Yep.
So the eggs. One of the prisoners can eat anything. Like they bet on everything. So they talk about how they've had a lot of bets about what he can and can't eat. So they're just talking about all these things that he's seen him eat. He's seen him eat this. He's seen him eat that. And then Luke just goes, I could eat 50 eggs.
Okay. Quantity. I was going to say, eggs is a thing people eat. So I was confused where this is going.
Like, I can eat 50 eggs, and they're all like, what?
Nobody, no man can eat 50 eggs.
No, don't do it. You're going to kill yourself.
Then they start to like work around like what are the outlines of this bet, like how, like, oh, in an hour it comes down, we're gonna do it in an hour, you know. It's like, oh, and what are we gonna, you know, everybody starts betting on it, and Dragonlord's like,
Kobayashi
Luke's my boy, I'm his trainer, I'm gonna take all the bets for Luke, you know.
Okay,
so then there's a whole sequence of egg training, like,
wow.
Are they like making him speed eat his lunch of like beans and rice and
like trying to stretch his stomach out and
stretch his stomach out? Yeah,
real competitive eaters things that they do. Like, this is okay.
So then there's the sequence of eating eggs, and
oh man, this sequence is awesome. This sequence is awesome. It's so good.
I cannot eat hard-boiled eggs. You guys know that. I hate the texture.
No, it is just disgusting. But.
And it's just a sequence of a man eating 50 hard-boiled eggs.
Does he chew, or is he just horfing them down?
It's a little bit of both.
Okay.
It's both a hard shell and a soft shell, porque no los dos.
Certainly.
So, like, you know, he's eating them fast, and he's eating them slow, and then at the end he has to, like, eat the last six, like, in a minute. He's literally just laying supine on a table, and they're like, I'm just gonna put these in your mouth. Like,
They're just poking eggs into his mouth.
Yeah. Ram jam them in.
And the final bit is they count down, and like he eats, and he's like, no, if he didn't swallow it, it doesn't count. And they like hold his mouth open, and there ain't no eggs in there.
Yeah. Sure.
And then they pull the camera back, and it's shot from above, and he's laying on the table in his underwear in a crucifixion pose. He looks like Scott Staff, you know.
Oh yeah, I know that one. Yeah, okay.
And he's got the biggest smile on his face, and like, that's the egg scene. Like,
that's weird. That's really weird. Would you say that? So this was under the umbrella of has been copied elsewhere. That doesn't seem like a thing I've seen before, but it is definitely interesting.
It's one of the iconic scenes. I don't know how much Eat 50 Eggs has been copied, but it's definitely one of the more iconic scenes.
That sounds fun. Sounds like a good romp.
Yeah, it is fun. And there are a lot of fun scenes in this movie, especially in the first like three quarters, like before
the first
the
escape
mother
attempt.
Scene, like of them, like of building up the relationships between the prisoners and building up the prisoners' relationship with Luke. That are really good and really, really interesting.
Fun.
And then there's the turn, and then it like turns into what it turns into.
Yeah, there's a lot of desperation. A lot more desperation than there had been.
Yeah, the description seemed very sad. Like, bleak. Sort of monotonically decreasing in happiness. But this sounds
but it's not. It's like, it's up and down.
Yeah.
And like, and it's kind of a slow pace. It's this slow plodding movie.
It does meander.
It meanders, but like, I wouldn't have it any other way, because I really liked, because I was interested in everybody's stories the entire time, and the way that they did like sound design, and the way that they like did minimal dialogue for a bunch of it was really good. I think
there's two parts. Oh, go ahead, Zach.
Oh, I was gonna say, I feel like prison movies lend themselves to this kind of thing, because you have sort of entirely equal characters, right? There's no, well, I mean, if you're talking about just the prisoners, there's no power dynamic.
Yeah,
I mean, I guess there sort of is, but like,
there always is a boss. I mean, Dragline is definitely the one in charge at the beginning, and you have to like respect him at the beginning.
Yeah, but it's this everybody's in this together kind of thing, where like they're all sort of on an equal playing field in a literal sense.
There definitely are scenes. There are scenes like that. Like after Luke comes back at one point, and the guards decide they really want to punish him. There's a rule where if you don't finish, you can take as much food as you want, but if you don't finish, you go into the box, and they just load his dish up with rice. Like, no, he could never eat this amount of food. Yeah. And then all the prisoners who have since like decided they don't respect him anymore,
oh,
still like take spoonfuls off of his plate.
They still want to take care of him. Like, they walk up in front of the guards and take handfuls of it in front of them.
Right. Yeah. So, like, the politics of this situation are always very interesting. And I feel like that, I think that lends itself to, because it's a thing that most people haven't experienced. So it's very fun to sort of get a window into that. Yeah.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. There's two scenes I wanted to bring up. One of them is when he's essentially digging his own grave over and over again. Yeah. And Harry Dean Stanton is in the background and he's playing spirituals. And the song he's playing is Ain't No Grave Gonna Keep My Body Down. Yeah. And I feel like if that happened in a movie now, I would say, okay, sure, whatever.
We get it.
Because it would be the Johnny Cash version and it would be superimposed over the scene. But for whatever reason, it just feels very natural here.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what I would say about the whole thing. Like, you talked about how heavy-handed the Christ imagery was, and like, but it didn't feel overwhelming. Like, it was clearly there, and I recognized that, but for once, it didn't bug me. Because I was like, yeah, no, he is this, like, sympathetic character that has a rough lot and is, like, but is, in general, a good person. And is trying to make the best of it, and there's
he talks a lot about he just feels unsettled. He always feels like he's killing time.
And
like all these crucifix poses and the crossroads at the end and everything, but like it never felt heavy-handed at the moment to me, which is really weird because you know how I have an antipathy for that sort of bullshit.
Yeah absolutely.
But I didn't notice it this time.
The other scene I wanted to bring up was the day when they're supposed to be tarring a road, and one of their things is like, well, we're gonna work as slow as they let us work, obviously, because we don't want to kill ourselves here. And Luke instead convinces them all to work really, really fast and really, really hard. And all the guards are so confused, and the whole thing ends up where they finally finish the road and it's still daylight.
And so they have 2 hours where they can just like chill out during daylight, which has never happened before.
Right. Oh,
they didn't either work till dark. Jail?
Well, they either work till dark or they finish their work for the day. That's the whole setup that they have. Luke, this scene of Luke convincing them like it's worth it just to have something,
those 2 hours of freedom,
some peace. That approaches freedom.
Yeah that's fun. So as far as the Christ stuff, is the implication that like Luke is sort of the leader of these people, these wayward folk, is like, is he the Christ, or what's the
definitely the Christ figure of it.
He's the Christ figure, but he's not like a leader so much.
So then it seems kind of shoehorned in. Like, what were they going for?
Well, I
think it's more of like an inspirational thing, and also reflect on the injustices.
Yeah, and like everybody looks up to him, but he's not really a leader. Like he's a well-liked, admired person, but he isn't trying to get them to do anything.
Okay, it's natural. Yeah.
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 Well, in the end scene where they're doing that weird montage, it's also everybody is gathered around Dragline like an old religious painting where there's someone preaching to a group of apostles.
It's John the Revelier or whatever.
Yeah, okay. Which is interesting because earlier he essentially is the Judas character who turns in.
Right, of course.
Yeah.
Well, unwitting. Like, they don't portray him as doing it on purpose, but...
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, and then the only other thing that I really wanted to cover was the man with no eyes and how he's such an ominous, evil figure.
It's really, really strange. I do have like one more thing after that too.
That's a tough starting point. Is a guy with no eyes that always wears sunglasses in a position of power? Yeah, that's.
Well, I mean,
yeah, no, he doesn't, and he doesn't. He never speaks.
Oh.
Well, no, he does. He's like, get me the gun, and that's about all he ever says.
It's sure. Yeah, it's like one. It's very short commands. He speaks in short commands.
Yeah. And, like, the prison warden is, you know, your emperor, and then you have this scary Darth Vader sort of figure.
That's exactly what I was thinking, yeah.
Yeah. No, it's there. It's all there.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, the name Luke is right there, I mean.
Yeah.
So Star Wars ripped this movie off, is that what we're saying?
I think that it's more like there's a lot of characters in this, and they just do a really good job with it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Sure.
They make them feel a little more rounded out, even when they are drawn broadly.
Yeah, exactly. I think it does a good job with that. What's the last thing you wanted to cover, Lee?
So, the guy who wrote the novel also helped write the screenplay, and a lot of the prison guard characters, like, the whole point behind them was just a description of, like, benign evil.
Yeah,
people who aren't necessarily evil themselves, but just let themselves get swept up or just carry out what is essentially evil or dehumanizing work.
Well, I mean, just following orders, that kind of comes up.
For sure, the
time when Luke is put in the box because he has rabbit in his blood.
Yeah.
He's like one of the guards is behind him, like getting him ready to go into solitary, and he's like, "Sorry, Luke, it's just my job." And he's like, "So what if it's just your job? Like, it's still the wrong thing to do. Like, why would you do this to me?"
I mean, in the context of the Vietnam War, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
And then the last thing, so George Kennedy won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor for this movie.
Oh shit! Okay,
the guy who played Dragline. And he gives a great performance. Like, it's very good. And I looked up who else was nominated that year. Gene Hackman and Michael J. Pollard were nominated for Bonnie and Clyde. And I think George Kennedy's better than both of them were in that movie, personally. Okay. But that's a very good movie, too. But what I found very interesting about it is I read an interview where George Kennedy said, he goes, my movie, like Cool Hand Luke did really well, but it wasn't getting a lot of press around awards season. So I took out a bunch of ads in Variety with my own money and all the different trade papers, just pumping up my chances for an Oscar. I spent $5,000 of my own money.
Wow.
And I won.
67.
Yeah.
Yeah. Literally bought
and
an
I
Oscar.
Won and immediately, well, there's a much more notorious story about that I could tell you too.
Oh, certainly. Yes. Okay.
But George Kent, you know, he bought a bunch of ads, which is what studios do now. Like, they'll buy ads for different actors in the trades. Like, hey, don't forget, come awards season, Cate Blanchett was amazing. And like, who could forget about Cate Blanchett? But that's what they do.
I mean, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And he spent $5,000 and he ended up winning. And I don't know when he started buying these ads, but like, he didn't win any of the other major awards for Best Supporting Actor that year. He only won the Oscar. So something worked. Like he won, and he said, I spent this money up front, and then immediately I started being able to ask for 10 times what I was getting paid before I won. So,
wow.
Uh-huh. Yep.
Quite the business opportunity. Well done.
So he really he's believed in himself, and he really got it done.
Not bad.
And he's
not
great bad. In this movie. He's
very good. A good job.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of emotion in this movie.
Okay.
That's all I've got. What about you?
So
I mean, that's mostly it.
Before we get to it, who else bought an Oscar?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm. Most notorious example of a person buying an Oscar. And this actually led to a bunch of changes in how the Academy did their voting.
Oh.
I think it's 1967. It might be the same year. It may have been the Oscar ceremony prior to this one.
Wow.
Okay. But I'd have to look it up. Cliff Robertson won for the movie Charlie. Charlie is an adaptation of Flowers for Algernon.
Oh. Uh-huh. Okay.
And he and the movie studio and the producers and the director and all this notoriously bought gifts specifically for Oscar voters. It went beyond buying ads. They literally hey, here's a ticket to this premiere for that movie with that actress you think is pretty lecherous old man, and like you only get to sit down and have dinner with her, and like, oh, did we leave this gift basket with all these things you love, and like, you know. So it was
assorted
a very,
meats and jams.
Yeah, it my was favorite. A very, very open secret that Cliff Robertson literally bought his Oscar that
year.
Right.
Sure.
And it led to a lot of changes in the Academy. So like,
yeah.
when George Kennedy talks about I paid for ads, like that is the most like. Fuck yeah, you paid for ads. Good for you, George Kennedy. Like,
that's a very passive cheating. That seems okay.
Yeah. It's not even cheating, I think. But
no, yeah. Well, whatever. And the Academy's still bullshit, so whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
50 years later.
Well, anyway. Hey, good for fucking George Kennedy for getting himself a raise. Like, let's...
Yeah, yep.
Right on.
Not quite a raise.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Although, in the words of Fozzie Bear, 10 times 0 is still 0. But...
sure enough.
A waka waka.
ratings?
Right, so
on that note.
one, this movie made a lot of money.
It did. It was very successful.
The budget was 3.2, and the box office was 16.2.
Oh, back then, that's not bad.
In 67.
Yeah, in 67, that's a lot of money.
That's
a ton.
Pretty,
yeah.
It's a pretty good chunk of change.
Yep.
So as for the IMDb rating, this is an 8.1.
Holy fuck. All right.
Yeah. Is it on the top 250? I feel like it could.
Definitely.
Seems
definitely,
like
without
it
without a doubt.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know for sure, but like it.
Oh,
I,
it's,
no.
It's number 171.
Yeah, 171.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's pretty good.
I think it's better than that, but that's me. Lee, how do you feel about the movies, Zach?
I'll start with Zach. I liked it. You know why I liked it? Because I liked The Hustler. And to America.
Again, a movie I have never seen.
Yeah, which now we've poisoned the well for that one. And by extension, I think The Color of Money is just fine. It's definitely lower tier. Huh. That is the sequel to The Hustler. And that's the movie that Paul Newman finally won an acting Oscar for. Definitely one of Scorsese's lesser movies, but it also has Werewolves of London on the soundtrack, and it's super dope when it comes on. So
yeah, and that's all that matters.
Sure.
That's yeah.
Yeah. Let's go down to Lee Ho Fooks.
Get a big dish of beef
chow mein.
Anyway.
Turned into the Warren Zevon hour.
Oh, I love Warren Zevon. Hey, that was a couple episodes ago.
Sure enough.
Yeah. It's a good movie. I choose to believe that you did not know you made The Hustler, although a weird ice cream hustler. I'm going to call your movie The Ice Cream Hustler.
That sounds
great.
I like
it. Yeah. I can give that movie a 7.
Okay. Uh-huh. That seems entirely fair. Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. Cool Hand Luke is a movie that, as I mentioned up front, I was sure I had seen, and I'm sure that I hadn't. It is just that... It is full of that many iconic things. Oh, we also left out the like repetition of anytime one of the prisoners needs to do something, they have to ask permission. So it's like, taking it off there, boss. Take it off there, drag line. And like,
okay.
Yeah. This repeats throughout the whole movie.
Wiping it off there, boss. Wipe it off.
Wipe it off there, Luke. Yeah.
That does sound familiar. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So see, it's incredibly iconic.
Yeah.
And like Seth said, like it is super Christ imagery, and I don't think I like the way it's directed. I think the directing is very weird.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think the score is very good, but doesn't necessarily...
I love the score.
It's a great score. I just don't think it matches up to a lot of the scenes sometimes. Mm-hmm. It feels like it's out of sync with the movie a little bit.
I'll disagree with you, but...
Anyway, all right.
Okay.
But it's a movie that's incredibly iconic and incredibly watchable. I'm going to give it a 7.5.
Okay.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Seth, what you got?
Okay, so for the Ice Cream Hustler,
as it will henceforth be known.
No, I mean, I always like, I very much enjoyed The Hustler, so why wouldn't I like this? And I also very much enjoy ice creams.
Sure. And so, Dubious Science? Dubious Science is always great.
Dubious Science is my bread and butter.
Okay. Bump yourself up 0.2 on my rating, Zach. I forgot about the Dubious Science.
Was that 0.5?
Cold hands are great for pool.
Yeah.
Man, I was trying to
know that I... At one time, wanted to have my body donated to pseudoscience when I die.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Natch. Uh-huh.
And then I remembered that there's a lot of really bad and racist pseudoscience out there. So
true. Ooh,
historically, yes. Yeah. I couldn't wedge the cryotherapy was the best, like, even remotely plausible explanation I could come up with for this nonsense.
Yeah.
Sure.
It's a real Marky Mark storyline right there.
Yeah.
Sorry, Seth. I super cut you off.
Yeah. Well, for ice cream party to Electric Boogaloo, I'm going to give you a 6.7. 6.8.
Okay. That's a Seth fair. I'll take
it. Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
And then for the real cool hand, Luke, which
this is where I'm getting fucked.
Yeah, unfortunately you probably are. Yeah. I really, really enjoyed watching this movie again.
Sure.
I thought that the pacing was really good. I thought that the music actually matched because it's a very simple score. It's a lot of like solo guitar. Or solo, like Luke plays a banjo when he's sad, and like there's so much emotion.
That scene was very affecting. Yeah.
Yeah. Right after his mom dies, or after he gets the news that his mom dies, he just like sits on his bed. Everybody else in the room like backs away, and he just sits on his bed and he sings himself a sad banjo song.
Oof.
And it is very affecting to me.
Yeah,
And it wasn't the Rainbow Connection, the canonical sad banjo song.
It's true. It wasn't quite certainly, that, but certainly. You know, it was close enough. Sie lebten die Traumer und ich. It's sadder in German.
Most things are.
Yeah, it's called, but the thing is, in German, it's called Der Regenbogenanschluss.
just too much. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to offend you. You sound offended.
Why are there so many songs about rainbows?
Der Regenbogen!
That's pretty good. Yeah.
Brian Henson's gonna have our ass.
Okay, so but this movie is long, but it didn't seem long when I was watching it. Like, and it's slow, but it didn't seem slow to me. And I think that Zach, even you would like it. Despite
It's not in the Zach Goldilocks zone for a movie that's short enough to watch. But
I mean it's not a Run Lola Run again. I was gonna say, it's like just Run, two Lola episodes Run. Of Star Trek, but that's fine.
Yeah, it's Run Lola Run Primer end of list. That's it. Like those are the only
solid ones. List though. I mean, those are both
those
good
are
movies,
both very
so...
good movies. It's true.
Both movies I've never watched.
Oh fuck!
You've never seen Primer, dude? What the fuck?
Well,
okay. I've owned a copy of Primer for 12 years. I'm just, if I haven't watched it yet, I'm not going to watch it.
Okay. Missing out.
I think that this is one of my favorite movies of all time. It's not, obviously, episode 69, Star Trek 4.
Certainly.
But it's probably a better composed movie than that.
Certainly far less shaggy.
With much better acting because Paul Newman is just the most charming motherfucker in the world.
Better whale effects too, oddly enough.
Yeah, it's strange. That in the desert they would have so many good whale effects.
We're farming
whale
dirt whales out here.
Oh boy. But Paul Newman is also one of my favorite actors of all time. I think that he can just emote so much better than almost anybody else that I can think of.
Throwing out like a confident smile gets across more than a lot of actors just like.
Yeah.
Zach, before we recorded, you were talking about Darkest Hour. Like, Gary Oldman looked like a literal Muppet wearing that makeup.
He did. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, Paul Newman just cracking an uncomfortable smile tells me more about his character than Gary Oldman wearing a fucking Industrial Light and Magic created Jabba the Hutt costume. Like,
Yeah. That's a very evocative description of him in that movie. Yes.
It's accurate.
No, it is. It is.
But, like, Paul Newman has the ability as an actor to smile with his eyes, which is very, very rare.
So he's smizing, is what you're saying.
He is smizing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I don't know what that term means, and
TM,
I don't like
TM,
it.
TM, Tyra Banks, TM.
Yeah. I will point you, though, to Richard Harris for being able to express discomfort with his eyes. He is a master of that.
True. But right. I'm going to give this movie an 8.3.
Okay.
All right. Damn. Yeah, that's a really good score.
That's a really good score for me.
Yeah, it sure is. Sure do.
But I really enjoyed this movie, and people should watch it.
Yep.
Despite various flaws.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not perfect, but it's.
I mean, what
it's
movie is
very good? It's very good.
Star Trek IV.
I was literally just looking past the past scores, and all of your scores are garbage except for the 10-10-10 on The Voyage Home.
Yep. And then this, which is weird.
This might be your second highest of all time, yes.
Probably. Yeah. Probably is.
Yep.
I really enjoyed it, so.
Yeah. All right, so next week, I think TBD, I guess it's historically would be a guest. I think we can probably make that work, but we're not sure what it's going to be.
Yeah, we're looking. We've definitely got some movie ideas, including double bread socks.
On.
Seth. we'll have something for y'all.
Until then.
What's so amazing that keeps us stargazing?